Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Viverito, making news this week for the rare political act of giving up some of her power. Speaker Mark Viverito later this hour. Also, the provocative linguist today, John McWhorter. We will talk about everything from Donald Sterling and affirmative action to his new book that says the world looks the same in any language. And it wasn't Governor Christie's office causing that traffic jam in Englewood Cliffs last night. Why hundreds of people turned out, despite the drenching rains, to a public hearing on an office building that could alter the course of history for the Palisades. All that coming up this morning. But we begin today with a look at the Thomas Piketty phenomenon, which can only be called that, a phenomenon. The new bestseller by the French economist, if you haven't heard about it yet, is 577 pages long. And as it happens, it has spawned approximately 577 reviews, blog posts, think pieces, and more. Everyone in the world seems to have written and talked about Piketty's book called Capital in the 21st Century. The left sees it as final proof of the corrosive effects of concentrated wealth. The right sees it as more class warfare. So now, seven Thomas Piketty think pieces we read so that you didn't have to, and the seven questions they raise. This is how it works. When you wait long enough in the news cycle, you can just have others set up your questions for you. It's easy. And to help guide us through our tour of Thomas Piketty think pieces is Mike Consul, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who writes about economics at Rorty Bomb. He did his duty and wrote a Piketty think piece too, which is generally favorable, but also serves as a great roundup of various reactions to the book. So no better person to guide us. Mike Consul, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And for people who don't know, as I'm trying to, you know, approximate the French pronunciation here, the name is P-I-K-E-T-T-Y. So it looks like Piketty to an English speaker, or sort of Piketty if you're doing it in French. And think piece number one. And we start with Gillian Tett in the Financial Times. She writes, quote, Piketty's tome is exhaustively researched and contains numerous statistics showing that the American economist Simon Kuznets was wrong to argue back in the 1950s that economies would become more equal as they matured, unquote. Now, that may sound a little dense, folks, but talk to us about that language, Mike, that background, because it's really important. The idea that economies would become more equal as they matured, which Piketty sort of argues has been the driving idea of modern capitalism. That's fundamental, right?
Right. So if you look back at the 1950s, which was the last time economists really surveyed this data, they were looking at the time right around then. And the thought was, and this is basically taken hold in the economics profession, is that, you know, during the Industrial Revolution, you had a lot of inequality. Before the modern era, you had a lot of inequality. But something about mature economies as they, you know, kind of, you know, as you have a broader middle class, as you had more educated people, as you had a lot, you know, broader tax base and all this, the economy would naturally gravitate towards equality, towards more equalness. And so, you know, a lot of economists would say, you know, even though there's been a lot of inequality lately, and, you know, a lot of people are worried about that, given enough time, given a generation or two, it will naturally bring back to, you know, a more equal base, or, you know, not pure equality, of course, but a much more, you know, egalitarian distribution of resources. And what Piketty says is basically that mid-century period after World War II up until about the 1980s is really the anomaly we have to explain. A lot of our indicators are going back to the late 19th century.
So the real shift in focus with Piketty isn't on the way the wealthy get rich, but the way that that wealth is then concentrated and protected.
Absolutely, right. And so basically the tendency of old wealth to grow faster than new wealth. So, you know, he has a phrase that the past devours the present. And, you know, basically what he's saying is that as the wealthier get wealthier, they take up more space, they take up more of the focus of the economy. And that's, you know, he talks a lot about literature through it. He talks a lot about cultural things. It's a very long book. It's like 600 pages. And, you know, he basically gives a broader holistic view that, you know, under this kind of inequality, you know, the past will really tend to dominate the future, and it will look a lot more like the late 19th century, which should be our default thinking as opposed to the 1950s.
And listeners, we should say that we have posted all the quotes and the charts that we will be discussing from the various think pieces that we're reviewing on our website. So for extra credit, or you could think of it as the Thomas Piketty debate spark notes, go to our website and follow along at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. You will see the raw material we're working from right on the page. And no piece of that raw material is more fascinating than this chart that we're about to discuss. From Piketty think piece number 2, and not surprisingly, the left has latched on to this argument. In Esquire magazine, there's a piece called The Most Important Book of the 21st Century. And, of course, the only way to follow up on a headline like that is with a graph. So do you want to describe this graph that we're looking at, which actually begins at antiquity and runs to the present, and why people think this is so revolutionary in analysis?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's important to understand that the book itself, before you get to the debates about inequality, which will become very heated and political,
right,
just as a data source, it's a fantastic book. It's all it's an exhaustive global project to unearth historical data about how the economy has evolved. That's, you know, amazing, and I think a lot, that itself is worthwhile. Now, the graph, which is available on your webpage, has two things. You're often going to hear people talk about R greater than G. I think that's the kind of, you know, who is John Galt kind of equivalent of this book.
And when people tweet, like, you know, it's like wearing the mask that people associate, the Guy Fawkes mask that people associate with the Occupy movement, right? If people are tweeting,
right,
R is greater with the greater sign for math, R is greater than G, that means I'm a Piketty fan, right?
Right. That's the code, I think, that, you know, hopefully there won't be, you know, spray paints of it or anything like that, but maybe there'll be buttons or something. But crucially, so what the graph shows is that R, which is the rate of return on capital in the economy, it's basically how profitable it is if you own something. And it's, you know, a very narrow measure, and it encompasses everything from stock ownership to home ownership to land ownership if you're, you know, you own farms in the 17th century. If you combine that all into one rate of return, you know, if you invest $100, how much do you have a year from now? He says basically it's been about 4 to 5% from antiquity up until the World War I, essentially. And he goes through a bunch of historical things, but he also historical data, but he also goes through novels, for instance. And, you know, you can pull apart Jane Austen novels and read about how, you know, where it's very clear that's a 5% return. Now, what he's saying is that the shocks of World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, and the kind of wave of legislation that came out of there, you can think of things like the war mobilization in the U.S., the New Deals, you know, the New Deal, and you know, the subsequent waves of reform like Social Security and labor reform, that is what all those things combined, and we'll talk about later about which ones were most important, drove down the rate of return. And we also had a huge growth spurt where, you know, there's a period where we were, you know, a really productive economy. We innovated very quickly. You know, people went from, you know, had indoor plumbing and, you know, very quickly. So the growth was bigger as well. And now we're back, we're moving quickly back to the old period where the rate of return was much higher and growth was much lower. And that tends to exacerbate the inequality. That's when the wealth of the past, which is, you know, essentially the return on capital, is growing much faster than the economy in the present, and that tends to have the past dominate the future.
And so, for example, what we've been seeing in this country recently, just to put it in very simple, concrete terms, with the stock market rising so much faster than the general rate of growth of the economy or the general rate of growth of average people's wages, that's R is greater than G, right?
Absolutely. That's a framework to do it. And, you know, it's funny, I see it getting mentioned when it comes to, like, the stock market like that, but also when it comes to things like, you know, someone pointed out, like, rich kids of Instagram or whatever, you kind of see these, like, displays of wealth that are very, you know, gratuitous. You can kind of think, oh, yeah, of course, R is greater than G. So I'm curious if that'll evolve and be caught as a kind of catchphrase.
Mike Contal from the Roosevelt Institute, giving us our 7 think pieces we read so you didn't have to, guide to the Thomas Piketty book on capital, which is all the rage around the world right now. I think we can say that literally. And let's move on from what Piketty thinks is wrong to the what he thinks should happen part of the program, and we turn to Felix Salmon, formerly of Reuters, and his think piece on the book, and basically Salmon isn't buying it. I quote, Piketty's rather French idea of a global wealth tax isn't getting nearly the same amount of acclaim as the rest of the book is, and is very unlikely to happen. Countries will always compete with each other to attract the stateless rich by not taxing them, unquote, from Felix Salmon. So want to explain this Piketty idea, his proposal for a global wealth tax?
Right. So the book ends on a couple of notes, but the thing that is most caught on is the policy solution is a global wealth tax that's coordinated internationally, at least among the rich countries. So you can think of Europe and North America. He proposes this for a couple of reasons. One is that he thinks it's necessary. We'll talk about other possible solutions in a minute in another think piece, but he thinks it's necessary. It's necessary to kind of divert some of that wealth towards the public purpose, towards funding important public goods and social insurance and whatnot. He also wants it as a means of accountability so that, if there is a tax, even if it's a very small tax, I believe he proposes a 2% wealth tax in it, but he says we can even start lower, but he wants it so that the wealth is visible. Right now, a lot of wealth is in tax havens. It's essentially disappeared. He quotes a little bit about how if you add up all the wealth claims, it seems like we owe Mars a bunch of money because there's a bunch of claims on wealth that just don't exist on Earth, which means that they're essentially hidden in tax havens. So he thinks if you have to pay just a little bit, it'll expose it to democratic scrutiny. We'll have a little bit better sense of what's going on. And from my point of view with the text, it seems like a very European solution that did, the book is originally written in France, in French, and it seems like much more focused on the mix of EU and how they're going to fund themselves.
And it seems to me, though, that whether you think the tax would work or not, the big step here is that Piketty is putting a fine point on the idea of wealth inequality as opposed to income inequality. Yes?
Absolutely, yeah. The book, there's a reason it's called Capital. And, often when we think in terms of U.S. inequality, we think in terms of labor inequality, which, is basically, there's a janitor and there's a CEO, and the CEO makes 500 times the janitor, where before he only made 300 times or 100 times. If you get to choose how much money you're making in a year, if you're cashing out stocks, if you own a business, that's really the kind of capital, that's income from capital. And that tends to evade taxation in a way that your individual labor income doesn't. It's taxed at a lower rate. We can remember Mitt Romney paying, 12% taxes, or Warren Buffett paying less in taxes than a secretary. That's the kind of wealth inequality we're talking about. And his idea is to put the wealth tax back on the agenda in a way that, people can then react to.
And so on to think piece number four. And hey, it's yours. You wrote in your own piece about Piketty in the Boston Review that, quote, he is in a way saying, go ahead and make whatever reforms you want, break up the banks, pass the campaign finance package of your dreams, reach deep into the bag and pass all the non-reformist reforms you could think of. All your reforms cannot guarantee that you are safe from the logic of R is greater than G. So why did you write that?
Sure. So an initial wave of the debate, so there's been a ton of reviews of the book, and a general complaint from more liberal-minded reviewers, especially liberal-minded reviewers who are economists who work with policy and work in D.C., is that he doesn't have a really good story about how we can use more regular regulations to fix this. Like, would a higher minimum wage help? Would more unions help? Would, stricter financial reform help? Campaign finance help? And he has an ambiguous relationship with this in the book. I think what he thinks is that the big thing that came out of the New Deal and the wars were both the actual destruction, of people, buildings, and claims, but also really high progressive taxation. If you are having a CEO pay 80% of any income he makes over $1 million, that's going to cap a lot of inequality because the board will not make a payment that way. Crucially, what I read him is saying is, so a lot of people are saying, why don't we, focus on financial reform or focus on patents or focus on health care?
And he's all the things we actually usually debate in this country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the thing that's contentious all across the board, every day. He's saying, he's a pretty lefty guy. So he's saying, yeah, absolutely, these are good ideas. You should do them. But I don't think they will change my dynamics. I think you really need to get serious about taxes in a way that people do not talk about taxes, which is like on wealth, high rates, internationally coordinated and so on.
And our think piece number six comes from David Brooks in the New York Times, who not only sees a sort of class warfare angle, which conservatives don't like about Piketty, but more centrally, he thinks that Piketty is missing the point when it comes to the role of government and how to actually help all these people in the 99% or however big it is who are disadvantaged by the concentration of wealth. Brooks writes, what conservatives need to do in response is, quote, emphasize that the historically proven way to reduce inequality is lifting people from the bottom with human capital reform, not pushing down the top. In short, counter angry progressivism with unifying uplift, unquote, writes David Brooks. So do you think he has a point that Piketty is having a conversation about taxing the rich? Ooh, those bad guys up there, they've concentrated so much of the wealth for themselves, when we really should be finding ways to help the middle, which taxing the rich doesn't actually do?
Sure. So, I mean, when you talk about inequality, you're usually having three conversations. One is, the relatively deteriorating position of people who are poor right now, people at the bottom of the income distribution. A second conversation about people at the median who, depending on how you measure it, are having stagnating or slightly increasing incomes, but, are suffering under health care costs and education costs and so on. And then there's the issue of the 1%, people at the very top of the income distribution who are having really runaway incomes. It's very easy to fight over what should be the priority when we talk about inequality, and those are three very important issues. And you can always judge which one is the most important. I don't think up until this point we've had such a definitive account of what is going on at the top 1%, and particularly one that kind of points to the fact that it will not fix itself on its own. That problem will, if you view it as a problem of a very small group of people claiming a huger part of our economy's resources, just won't naturally take care of itself. So, I think this puts it on equal footing. I don't want to say equal footing, but it puts it on the agenda in a way that where it's very obvious why we should be worried about poverty or stagnating wages, it wasn't clear. A lot of people were very optimistic about the 1% issue taking care of itself. They can no longer say that after this book.
And this is a fundamental step he takes. People even on the left have been willing to concede the idea that the rich should be allowed to get super rich as long as we help the very poor and the middle be comfortable. But Piketty is kind of saying that the very rich are actively impeding the rest of us just by concentrating their wealth.
There's a political story there, but there's also just a straightforward economic one. He makes a case that's plausible. People are debating it, that in addition to the wealth just concentrating, it will also take up a bigger share of the economy. So, all the wealth we make in our economy is paid out either to capital or labor, and lately labor's been getting a smaller share of it. And that directly impedes, middle-class people, working poor people, everyone. And he's saying that that will actually get bigger. It will go from, 25% to 35 or 40%. And that, I think, will be the real bite. And that is what has a lot of people worried. And that actually makes the 1% problem interconnected with all the other problems.
Mike Consell, our guest from the Roosevelt Institute, as we talk about the book that is all the rage and topic of conversation among economists and policy wonks in the world the last few weeks, by Thomas Piketty, the French economist called Capital in the 21st Century. And as we near the end of our tour of seven reviews of the Piketty book that we read so you don't have to, number seven, Tyler Cowen in the New York Times, who writes about how many French economists are baffled by the reception that their fellow French economist is getting here in the U.S. He's been on the scene there for a while and in some ways is seen as, passé by this point in France. So is this just a matter of the U.S. catching up to a conversation that took place in Europe a decade ago?
It's a good question. I think people in France have politics that that deal with aristocracy, deal with high taxation, deal with taxes more generally in the way the U.S. does not. The U.S. has a real entrepreneurship feel. It has, we built this, it has a, small business focus. There's never been an aristocracy here outside, historically, not certainly not in the same way there is in Europe. So it's a very new concept to Americans. So I think that's of interest to them. I think there's also an issue where Americans like it when French people show up and kind of explain the country to them, which is always very fascinating. And the book, though it's obviously very political, doesn't feel partisan. I think in part because it has a historical international focus and it's written by someone outside the U.S. So I think it's going to be convincing and interesting for people who don't particularly like partisan media to really kind of deal with these very deep, important economic issues.
Now, listeners, I refer to you to our comments page because some of you are starting to post links to your favorite reviews of Capital in the 21st Century. So keep them coming. If we collect every one of the reviews, this could be the longest comments page in the history of WNYC or the history of comments pages. But keep that Piketty conversation going at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We have to end it here for the radio portion. But we will say apologies to Heidi Moore, Paul Krugman, Ross Douthat, The New York Sun, The New York Post, National Review, Jonathan Chait, and many others. Yes, we read your think pieces too, we promise. And we thank Mike Consul, fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, who also writes about economics at Rorty Bomb. He's been our tour guide to the Thomas Piketty think pieces, and you can find a link to his piece, as well as all the others we cited today and some of the charts and graphs on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, why the deal to save Long Island College Hospital in Brooklyn is on the verge of falling apart. Stay tuned.